Chapter 8. The sun comes up. Garstag walks out to the far edge of the complex in order to observe it. It is a little rite for him, a small habit that he sees no reason to extinguish. After every successful action, he makes sure to see the sun come up on the worlds he has conquered. He has seen many suns rise, blazing blue-white orbs that sent shadows leaping across the rocks, mid-range yellow stars that must be reminiscent of Terra for those who remember it, and ones like this one, old and tired and amber, filling a sixteenth of the sky with a weary light. The complex is still burning. Slurt discovered promethium tanks and set them off. After that, he drove a few survivors into the inferno, where they were caught between death at his hands and death in the flames. It was a poor game, that, one that the Cardane Master disapproved of. They deserved a chance to die on their feet. He walks out further, getting away from the acrid smell of charred flesh and metal. The skies are dusty, still blown by an incessant boom of wind. In the distance, he can see towers studding the landscape at regular intervals. Between them is nothing, just a wasteland of rustling corn. He keeps walking. He passes a huge vehicle, its innards twisted and its internal machinery ripped out. Hoppers, each one capable of storing hundreds of tons of material, have been pulled apart, and the dust and grain are mingling into a dry slurry underfoot. He hears something out in the wastes, and walks away from the abandoned vehicle. He sees Clado kneeling out in the middle of one of the hyperfields, and lumbers over to join him. The surgeon doesn't appear to notice him coming, or perhaps is merely too engrossed in his work. Garstag sees what he has been up to. The severed bodies of Imperial servitors are lying in the dirt all around him, dozens of them. Some are clearly missing body parts. About 50 are waiting meekly for his attention, standing in the field with their eyes focusing well into the distance. They're big creatures, bred for muscle, with absurdly small heads perched atop all that vat-grown bulk. Clado looks up. He has a needle in one hand, thread in another.
"What?"
he snaps. Garstag does not ask what he is doing. The Brotherhood of Surgeons is notoriously secretive. If he had to guess, it would be that there is no clear purpose here, and that Clado is simply bored. Perhaps he wishes to test the pain tolerances of these things, or merely see if they can be recombined in some novel way.
"Not much of a theatre," Garstag says.
Clado stops what he is doing and looks around. The wind-blown crops whisper back at him.
"Where was their support?"
he asks. Garstag nods.
"It's a big world. There's a lot of fodder here."
There should have been a response. Even if the planet itself did not maintain an adequate garrison, there should have been an alert network within the system primed to respond. That was how the Imperium operated. It could not guard every single hunk of rock that it laid claim to, but it could act quickly when the alarm was raised. Garstag has seen this many times. A target would be hit, and within hours there would be landers darkening the skies. It was what they had all hoped for, a cascade of steadily increasing resistance, something to get their claws into. Clado puts his bloody materials down and gets up.
"It's like they've given up,"
he says. Garstag snorts.
"You saw what it was like at the gate. I don't think they've given up. Maybe we have, though."
Clado looks intrigued.
"What do you mean?"
Garstag almost doesn't tell him. It is hard to know when the time is right.
"Don't tell me you would have chosen this target," he says carefully.
"No one chose it. It's where we ended up."
"Yes. Strange, that."
Clado suddenly looks angry. His moods are like a child's, quick and complete, swinging from one extreme to the other.
"There's been plenty of talk. Don't add me to it, or I'll be stitching you to something foul."
Garstag laughs.
"Nah, we shouldn't be anywhere near here. We should have followed the despoiler out of Cadia."
He sighs, feeling his muscles ache for more action.
You and I both know it, Surgeon. He's lost his way.
Who?
Asks Clado, looking shrewd. It is a big thing to name the Primarch. They do not openly criticize him, for they know that words, even whispered ones, have a way of carrying back to the plague planet. For some in the Legion, Mortarion is little less than a god, a slayer sage elevated into the skirts of immortality. Even for those who think otherwise, he is still the most powerful of them all, a creature capable of turning the universe inside out in the cause of vengeance. Since his return to speech and activity, it has become perilous even to voice doubt, to utter a word of concern. In any case, that is not who he meant.
Tell me, Surgeon, Garstag says, who gives a damn for Ultramar? I do not. I do not care whether it prospers or rots. How about you?
Clado thinks for a moment, then slowly nods.
We do not set the course.
So, what do you want from this? I never asked you.
Clado laughs.
A better world. More subjects for my predilections.
Liar!
Garstag stalks moodily away.
He's led us for a long time. I find the obsessions wearying. It can't go on, brother.
Then do something.
You recommend it?
Clado shrugs.
Don't come here fishing for support. Do something or hold your claws closed. That's the way of things.
I find it interesting to gauge views. That is all.
Clado snorts and gets back to his work. The needle flickers, snicker snack, and surgical thread weaves.
I'll say this for the Siege Master. He was there, like I was. We both reached out, saw the walls, and for a moment they were falling. Falling! It was so, so close. And he's never stopped fighting. I did, for a long time. It's not easy to keep the hatred alive, sometimes, especially in the eye, where there are diversions.
We're not in the eye, though, are we?
Neither are we where we were supposed to be.
And you know nothing about how that happened.
Do you?
They look at one another for a moment, a slight push of strength against strength. Eventually, Garstag looks away.
You're making a mess of those things.
I'm making them better. That's our creed, brother. You should learn some religion.
Garstag's lips curl into something approaching disgust. Even now, even after he has seen and done so much, Clado's preferences can prove endlessly dismaying.
Think on it,
he says, turning back towards the ruins of the complex. The smoke from the last of the fires gusts about them, blown at a low level into the fields. But Clado is no longer listening. He beckons to another servitor, waiting mutely in line.
Next,
he says, brandishing the bloody needle. Dantine takes a long time to wake up. He is half aware of dreams in that time. He dreams of being taken up by men with no faces and carried somewhere far away. He sees stars swinging overhead, hundreds of them. At one point, he thinks he wakes, and he feels the shake of an orbital lander, and then the nausea of a rapid ascent. Then he is out again. He dreams of Bhattacharya, and somehow knows she is dead. He liked her, and believes she liked him. They might have achieved something together, had they not been stranded on such a nondescript world, and haunted by mutually incomprehensible pasts. He wonders why she was posted there. He wonders why he was never brave enough to ask her. Then he dreams that something is cutting him. He feels something being excised, dragged out of him. He hears voices, terrible voices, speaking through sputum in a language he does not understand. Then he stops dreaming. Much later, very much later, consciousness returns. He blinks, and a shifting world comes back into something like focus. He feels horribly ill, more than normal for a void transit. He is lying on his back, and he twists over to be sick. He sees the vomitor slap on the floor, thick and greasy, and the smell appalls him. Then he lies on his back again, panting. He is clammy and cold, and he shuts his eyes. His chest hurts. He does not want to be alive. That thought prompts him to force himself awake properly. Perhaps there is something he can do about that, spite the enemy before the advent of whatever questioning or torment they have in mind. He blinks again, hard, clearing room from his eyes. He tries to get a sense of where he is and what has happened. He is inside a cell, metal-lined, metal-floored. It stinks. Some of that stink is from him. His uniform is soiled and his various excreta reek. Foul matter is caked on every surface. The metal is heavily oxidized, stained and calcified. The floor is wet, and little bubbles pop to the surface of oily puddles. He is on a long bench, also metal, also rusting away to nothing. The lone lumen is a chain-suspended sodium lamp, as dirty as everything else. There are furry things with many eyes crawling up the walls. Dantin wipes his mouth and tries to sit up. His rib cage is the worst. He must have been hit hard there. His knife is gone, of course, as is anything else sharp. Aside from the smell, there is a taste in the air, a chemical taste, like something fermenting. He hears noises all around him, just as one always does on a starship. Noise resounds within a vessel in space from the total enclosure, running on top of the endemic growl of engines, air cyclers, water cyclers, shield generators, and the rest. But this one is different to any starship he has been on before. He can detect horrible noises just below the grind of the machinery. Some are moans, some are repeating cries, some are unidentifiable. Dantin is not a cowardly man, but those noises make him shiver. He looks up. The cell's solitary door is opening. Weak as he feels, he clenches his fists and prepares to move. Metal shrieks as the heavy door is shoved inward. Dantin leaps, seeing something huge and blurry in the gap, and going for it. He falls short, nearly passing out the instant he moves, and collapses into his own refuse. On his knees, he feels like weeping. He can barely lift a fist, let alone do his duty and attack his tormentor. He does not resist as huge hands reach for him, lift him up, place him back on the slab. Then he is looking up into the same eyes as before, at the number-scrawled plates, at the bizarrely pocked and bloated armor.
"Do not try that again," the monster says.
The voice is just as it was on Najan, like a throat submerged in oil, cracking and engine harsh. The language is also strange and hard to follow, though patently some form of Gothic.
"Why don't you kill me?" Dantin croaks.
The monster gives him a canister of water. He takes it and drinks greedily.
"I am named Vaux, siege master of the 14th Legion, called the Death Guard. You are on the ship Solace, in the care of the Lords of Silence. What is your name?"
Once a thing has a name, you can no longer call him it. He becomes a person, albeit of the most warped and esoteric kind. Even in the midst of his nausea and weakness, Dantin cannot escape a sliver of awe that creeps in. This warrior is old beyond imagination. That is evident just from the way he looks, moves, and speaks. He even smells old. One of the melange of aromas this creature gives off is the kind of decay only the truly decrepit exude. There had always been rumors, never spoken of except in the most intimate company, of space marines who had turned, who had given themselves over to the ruinous powers. Most sensible people discounted the notion. A space marine could not turn. But still, the gossip never went away. Dantin remembered serving with a lieutenant who swore that he'd heard a definite account of this happening, with campaign names and dates. 2 weeks later, that lieutenant was summoned to a meeting with the commissariat, and never returned. For most, that was proof he must have been spouting heretical rubbish. For a few thoughtful souls, though, it was enough to give them pause.
Captain Gaval Dantin, Najan Station Resident Defense Force, he says. I do not think you began your career on Najan, says Vorks. You fought like a man who knows how to use a weapon. Is this right?
He doesn't want to reply. He wants to remain defiant, to list his name and position again until they tire of it, and either kill him or bring in instruments of torment. Perhaps it is the eyes that do it. Looking into those deep lenses, swimming with what looks like some kind of marsh gas, drains his resolve. Or perhaps it is the crushing stink, his physical weakness, the knowledge that everyone who had served with him on that world is now dead.
I served in the Astra Militarum for 15 years. 15 years.
The creature, Vorks, shifts so that he is standing a little further off. His movements are almost awkward, as if the bones within that colossal hulk have been warped or rearranged. Things gurgle as he shuffles, or they drip, or they weep lines of glistening liquid.
That is a long time to stay alive in service. You must have been a good soldier, Captain Dantin.
Not really.
What brought you to Najan?
He does not wish to answer this. The creature senses it and, surprisingly, lets it drop.
No matter. Every man must have his secrets.
Vorks reaches up to brush a strand of something viscous from his gorget.
I have more important questions. The world you guarded was not unimportant. It should have been better protected. There should have been ships on response patrol. There should have been distress signals sent. Why was this not done?
Dantin doesn't know, but Acharya hadn't known. He shrugs and shakes his head.
We have analyzed your records, Vorks says patiently. There should have been naval support and regiments of your Astra Militarum on standby, and at the very last resort, you are under the protection of a chapter of Space Marines, are you not?
There seems little point in denying that. Dantin finds he wants to talk, and that disgusts him. He had hoped to be so much stronger.
The White Consuls, he says.
The White Consuls, Vorks nods appreciatively. A venerable name. Why are they not here?
Dantin shakes his head again, miserably.
Nothing works, he mutters. The beacon's down. The astropaths are dead. The sky's bleeding.
Why did he use that word? That's not like him. He's a soldier, not a poet. Vorks nods, taking it all in.
So, you are all blind now, just as the other one said. How interesting.
Dantin scowls.
There'll be a response from someone. You'll be sent back to...
He has no idea where these horrors have come from.
To the Eye of Terror, Captain Dantin, Vork says. You know that name, I assume. It has been our home for a long time, and not by choice.
He comes closer again, and the aroma of festering meat is hard to cope with.
It was a prison, rooted into the fabric of reality. Breaking it open, it appears, has also broken everything else. Perhaps that was anticipated by those who did it. Perhaps not.
He sniffs.
I find myself disappointed. We are cast adrift, and all has already been laid waste. I have my followers to think of. They are made for a life of conquest. If I cannot give it to them, they will find someone else who can.
Dantin cannot look away, even though he wants to. He feels sick again, as if his body has been scraped empty. He does not know what to say. He does not even know what to think.
I am a great horror to you,
Vork says. That is certainly true.
A long time ago, Vork says, I was a horror to myself. The universe is full of horror. You can resist it and drive yourself into madness, or you can accept it and then begin to understand it. I would recommend the latter course, though I accept you must feel quite differently for now.
The conversational tone is absurd. Dantin has seen what these things do. Why did you come here? He asks weakly, wishing he could think of something better to say, something more accusatory.
We did not come here by choice. The warp's winds blew us here. Before reaching your world, we had no fixed point to guide us. Now we know where we are, to a degree, and can plan where to go next. It is the beginning of something unexpected.
Dantin tries to make himself angry. He tries to remember all those he saw being killed. Why? He asks feebly.
Not for the reason you think.
Vorx lumbers off again. He seems to feel the need to keep moving, albeit in his stilted, stumbling manner.
There is a nobler way of living. We show this to the galaxy. We demonstrate it in our bodies, and we protect them from those who would harm it. We are the bringers of the gods' blessing.
Dantin stares at the monster. For a moment, he is entirely lost for words. You killed them all.
I did not kill you.
Why?
I do not know. Ha! Do you believe that?
The monster muses.
I am a believer in fate. I recognize a conjunction when I see one. For what it is worth, that has kept me alive for longer than most, and I do not intend to turn an opportunity aside.
Why do you do it? Dantin can feel himself losing control. He could become angry if he were not so worn out and nauseous. You were a man once, were you not? You were a human?
I still am of a kind.
Vorx is not looking at him.
We are all on a spectrum, Captain. You are at one end, I am at the other. We are still the same species.
You are mad! Vorx chuckles again.
I have lost count of how many times that insult has been aimed at me. By your kind, by my kind.
He is still pacing, as if counting out steps. There are things, sluggish things, that seem to be living in his armor.
The accusation is only meaningful if you can give me some suitable account of sanity. I saw the way you lived on that world. I have seen the way Imperial citizens live on 100 worlds. If you truly believe that this is a sane galaxy, and that we are the aberrations, then I pity you. But then, you have not seen all the alternatives yet. When you do, your mind may change.
Dantin tries to clench his fist. As the monster speaks, he attempts to gather the strength to lunge at him again. When he cannot do so, he slumps against the bench, defeated. "I wish to hurt you," he says mournfully. Vaux stops pacing.
"Of course you do. I do not blame you for that, but I cannot allow it. See, we have arts for this."
He reaches down to one of the many pouches at his belt. He rummages for a moment and then draws out a thick bag, stained black from the liquids within. He moves closer to Dantin, opens the bag, and brings something out. For a moment, Dantin does not know what it is. Then he thinks it is meat, raw meat offered as sustenance. Then he sees that it is a heart, blotchy with blood, and that it is still beating. The grisly spectacle makes him recoil until a greater horror dawns on him. His hands fly up to his chest, under the ripped jerkin of his uniform, and he feels the ridge of scar tissue there. Vaux puts the heart back in the bag and ties it to his belt again.
"Your first lesson," he says. "How are such things possible? They are not, in the only world you have ever known. But there is a greater one in which all things are made possible."
Dantin is hyperventilating. He cannot bear to touch the wound at his chest anymore. It makes him feel dizzy. "How did..." he starts.
"Hush," says Vaux,
holding a stumpy, calloused finger to his vox grill as he moves back to the door.
"Enough for one day. You will need to rest if you are to be of service."
"How am I alive?"
Vaux looks at him.
"Are you sure that you are, Captain?"
He opens the door and steps across the threshold.
"You are insane!" screeches Dantin, crawling after him.
Then the door clangs closed, and ripples travel across the watery filth on the floor. Dantin is trembling. He draws in huge breaths, unable to understand how he is still able to do so. "It is a nightmare. I will wake from it soon." He tries to sing the words of the hymn, the one they recited on the barricade, to give him strength. But he cannot remember the words. He looks around, at the walls and the ceiling, at the rot and the slurry. He smells the decay, the dankness, and sees how complete his prison is. By the time he is screaming, the cell door is securely locked. Dantin's despair adds to the cacophony of voices already raised, just one more addition to Solace's varied choir. It goes on for a long time, until unconsciousness takes him again, and the cell finally slinks back into its watery, torpid well of silence.